I have the benefit of having made a lot of mistakes and learned from those mistakes. And the truth of the matter is that that is the best way to learn. I don't care what anybody else says. F***ing it up is the best way to learn. I mean, there's a reason that like the guys who play baseball who are in the Hall of Fame, they struck out 70% of the time. And that's why they're in the Hall of Fame, because they took all those swings, right? But we sort of learned, we quickly realized that saving money or trying to save money on the construction, we were in the wrong mindset. And we kind of shifted our mindset a little bit into sort of, hey, we just want to focus on building quality, and we want sort of best in class working for us to build these buildings. And that may not be the cheapest way to do it. But what we ended up finding, and what we realized, and we've now proven this out many times over, building will probably get built faster. Building will probably get built with less issues. We'll probably have less issues after the building is complete. So it'll probably get us a higher value anyway. And you don't need as much aspirin for the process.
Okay, so New York is probably the most difficult real estate market to be a real estate investor. And I'm always fascinated by people that start out in New York, because it feels like you kind of just walked into Madison Square Garden to play basketball with Michael Jordan.
Yeah, it's I would say it's more like you walked into a subway for a knife fight holding a paperclip. That's probably a better analogy. But yeah, you know, look, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. But yeah, New York is definitely, and I've done business in other states now. And I can tell you, and that's not just because I'm a native New Yorker. New Yorkers are a different breed. I mean, there's a, you know, I used to think to myself, like when I'm down in, you know, other parts of the country and I'm waiting for my Starbucks order and it takes an extra like 3-4 minutes and I start like, the hell is wrong with these people? I'm not crazy. It's just I'm from New York. you know. So I think that's...
You have a different speed.
We really do. Yes, we really, really do. It you don't realize it. I mean, you know, it didn't, for the first probably 10 years, maybe a little bit more of my career, I'd only done things in New York. Although that's, that's not true. There was, you know, I did have a previous life where I didn't do real estate and I did interact with people from other states. But still, it's just not the same when you really do business in other places. You really, really understand the difference. And yeah, again, not to knock any other place. I'm doing a lot of business in Miami these days. So love Miami, love Florida. But it is a different animal. There's no question. No question.
How did you get started in real estate in New York City?
So, my story, I have a rather non-traditional sort of long story, right? My family came here as immigrants from the Soviet Union back in 78. I was 3 years old. So I don't really, we're 2.5 or 3. I don't really remember. And my dad was a watchmaker, which is just a fancy way of saying he fixed watches for a living. My mom was a manicurist. So we didn't grow up with much money. You know, it's funny. People often ask me like, you know, what does it take to be a developer? And I say, you need one of three things. Your dad has to give you $100 million. You need to be really good at finance or really good at construction. I didn't have number one, just FYI. Right. So I didn't really grow up with much money. And, you know, there were a lot of things that happened over the years, which some of them we could get into, but sort of just to kind of lay the track out. You know, I initially dropped out of college my first year for financial reasons. And I went into sales. It's a little bit of a long story, but this is like the mid 90s, I would say, right? I worked for Chase Manhattan Bank, which is now JP Morgan Chase, right? I was that guy that cold called you, like you're having dinner with your wife or whatever. And I'm like, hey, Jake, I see you got 20 grand in your checking account. You should open up a CD. Like I was doing that, right? And I was very good at that. Ended up working at a small stock brokerage firm. Ended up getting recruited by Morgan Stanley without a college degree. My first year at Morgan Stanley, my first 6 months, I was top 5 in the country. I finished my first year top 10 in the country. And this is right around, you know, the end of, this is around 2000, right after the dot-com bubble burst. My wife, was my girlfriend at the time, was going to law school. And she said to me, you know, we were getting serious. She said, no, I can never marry you unless you go back to college. And I said, why? And she said, because, you know, I know you're going to be successful. And I want our kids to say, you see, Dad didn't have to go to college. Like, why the hell should we go to? And the truth is, I hated what I was doing. I was a financial advisor at Morgan Stanley. And it just wasn't, you know, I didn't like the fact that I didn't have control. I was managing other people's money, but I didn't have control directly over the assets, right? So some analyst downstairs tells me to go buy Microsoft. I lose a bunch of money for some people, more money than I ever thought I'd have in my life. And what did I really do? I didn't do anything. And I actually had a number of clients that were in the real, just by chance, that were in the real estate business. And it was really through that, through being a financial advisor, that was my first sort of exposure to the real estate business and real estate investment, almost, you know, from sort of the other angle, right? And understanding it that way. So I quit Morgan Stanley, went back to school, went to NYU Stern, finished Stern in 2 years, got a job as a commercial mortgage broker with a guy named Jerry Schwartz, who ended up becoming my mentor in the business. Did about $2 billion of sort of debt and equity placements with him over the span of like 4 years. And then I met a guy named Jonathan Simon, who would become my partner. This is 2005, right? This is 20 years ago. Yeah, 20 years ago. I started a company called Simon Baron Development. You know, at that time, you know, by being a broker, I developed a couple of things. First of all, I built a lot of capital markets relationships. So I got to know like lenders, investors, private equity firms, right? Because I was doing that for other clients. So I was able to leverage that experience and those contacts. But the thing that I was missing, to be a developer, you need a balance sheet. I didn't have a balance sheet. I had no family money. Making a couple of bucks as a broker, but not, you know, the kind of balance sheet that you need really to borrow the kinds of money that you need to borrow to build these buildings. So I met a guy through the brokerage business. We kind of hit it off. We became partners in 2005. We did about $1.8 billion of deals together, mostly GPLP, you know, using private equity money. Spent about 15 years together. And then, you know, about 5 years ago, he retired. We rebranded as Baron Property Group. And we're just continuing to do the same things that we have done. You know, we shifted the business model about 7 years ago as the firm started to get bigger. We started to not completely move away from private equity, but you know, when we first started, my partner and I, he did have a balance sheet because he had some family money, but we still didn't really have like a lot of capital. So we were partnering with, you know, private equity firms, and we were sort of the small minority partner, right? Hopefully earning lots of fees and lots of promotes. And then as the firm sort of got bigger, we started to own more and more of our own deals and invest more of our own capital because we had some capital to invest. And then really about 7 years ago, we started to kind of shift where we want to be the majority now in our deals. So we're still taking private equity money. We still have private equity partners in our deals. But, you know, when you fast forward today, pretty much all the deals that we're doing, with the exception of two of them, we're the majority. You know, we're 65 to 75% of the ownership in the deals.
So let's take it back to your brokerage days, because you got an unbelievable perspective. You saw it from the outside, other people's money. You didn't have to take risk. You're sourcing debt and equity. A lot of people start that way. What did you see that you liked, and what did you see that you didn't like? And how did that kind of inform where you decided to start?
You know, I'll say this. I think the brokerage avenue, if you want to be a developer or a real estate investor, let's just say, right? I think one of the best avenues to get into that business is brokerage, whether that be capital markets brokerage, like commercial mortgage brokerage, debt, equity placement, that stuff, or investment sales. And the reason I say that is because you just get to see so much deal flow. You get to see so many deals. And the truth of the matter is that most, you know, when you really boil it down to real estate investing, it's really an understanding of the financials and the capital markets that's going to make or break the deal. Everything else you can kind of hire, all the other expertise you can hire. You can hire the property management and the contractors and that kind of stuff. But understanding how a deal gets capitalized and how that money gets raised and being able to go and raise that money, I mean, that's kind of the maker, that's the entry point, right? If you can't do that, you can be the best contractor in the world. You're not doing anything, right? So I think, and when you get to a place like take our firm or even take, you know, any large developer, you're not doing more than a couple of deals a year, at best, right? Especially if you're doing large scale development. Whereas when I was a broker, I mean, we could be looking at 10 deals a month, maybe more sometimes, depending on what's going on, right? So, and the great thing about that is now you're seeing what's working, what's not working, what the market wants to see, right? What lenders are going to tell you, this kind of sucks and here's why, or this doesn't work for us because our investors will never go, or this does, bring me more of this. This is the kind of stuff we want to see. The downside, you know, is that you're not sticking with these deals for the life cycle of the deal. You're kind of in at the entry point. So you're the broker, you're right. You're not taking any risk. I mean, you are taking, I kind of disagree with that statement a little bit. You are taking some risk because there's opportunity. As a broker, you're deciding what deals you're going to spend your time on. And theoretically, if it's not a good deal or the sponsor doesn't have the ability to pull it off, you could be spending a lot of time to, you know, make nothing, right? And it could be taking you away from other things. So there's some, you know, not, again, not the same thing as betting your own money and signing guarantees, but certainly there is, it's not completely riskless, but you're not seeing these deals through the end. You're kind of just coming in and, you know, at the beginning, getting the deals capitalized. In many cases, sometimes when the deals finish or mature, you'll kind of come back in to refinance and you'll kind of see the end point, but sort of like you're in at the beginning and maybe you're in again at the end. You miss this whole thing in here, right? The entire.
And that's, do you think that's where the magic happens, or does most of the magic happen on the buy with the location, with the initial business plan?
I think it depends on the deal, and it's a combination of things. I'll tell you a story that I once told one of my investors. You know, we had a deal many years ago where everything went right, literally. I mean, we bought the deal. We were, no bullshit, almost 2 years ahead of schedule. The budget was like 20% below budget. The rental, you know, it was a rental, but the rental rates went up 20% higher than what we had. Everything went right. We sold the deal. It was like a 60 IRR deal, right? We were having dinner afterwards. The investor and the guy says to us, he says, you know, that this is why you get make your promote. And I thought about it afterwards and I was like, you know, I actually don't think that's right. I think I got lucky. I think I really, you know, in those situations, I think I get paid. The truth is, when you're a developer, between the time that you close that deal and the time that you get to the end, so many things go wrong. So many things. And you expect them to. And it's our job, you know, when you know, you're supposed to kind of go from here to here and you're kind of going here. Our job is to get it back on track and get to the end point. So the best story that I can tell to sort of illustrate that is kind of like, okay, you and I are in Miami right now. Okay. There's a hurricane and we need to get to the Bahamas. We're getting on the ship and I'm the captain and we know there's a hurricane coming, but we got to get to the Bahamas. And I can't promise you that it's going to be a straight road, but I'm going to get you to the Bahamas. That's what being a developer is like. And sometimes the hurricane subsides, like in that sense, it's a smooth sailing, but most of the time you're in a fucking hurricane and you're getting thrashed around, but you get to the, you know, hopefully you get to where you're supposed to get to.
So unpack the comment that your partner made about the promote, because I agree, a lot of things do come down to luck, you know, timing, macro cycles and things like that. But it seemed like you didn't totally align with his view of the world around the success of the deal and your promote. What do you mean by that?
It was something that I thought about afterwards. In the moment, I just said, yeah, sure, great. Not right, but it got me kind of thinking afterwards, like the truth of the matter is we earn our money by making sure, you know, it's kind of like when you start a deal, you build these financial models. And these financial models have all these different projections. And this is another thing that I like to tell my investors and even lenders. I tell them like, look, here's the financial model. Here's the underwriting. Here's what I can promise you. 5 years from now, we look back at this underwriting, the deal will look nothing like this. It'll be a success. We'll make a lot of money, but it'll probably look nothing like this. You know, some people get very like, you know, shocked to hear that, but that comes from experience. The reality of it is that, look, the truth is no one knows what's going to happen years and years out. You do your best to project and prepare and create cushions so that you have the ability to maneuver. But real estate in general, you know, I think one of the biggest and best secrets to real estate is understanding time. You know, time can really, really make or break real estate. And I say that in a way, not like, because I don't know if I agree that it's that luck is a big part of it. True. Sometimes people do get lucky. That is a fact. I don't think you need luck to be successful in this business. I think you can make your own luck. And I think the real trick of it is, like, if we look back to the summer of 2020, right? COVID summer, okay? You give me anyone's asset in the summer of 2020, it's worth zero. Everyone in the world was underwater on their balance sheet in June of 2020, right? Every asset was worth zero because there's no bid, right? So your balance sheet, your net worth is this or negative, right? But fast forward 1 year, everything's back.
Right? Everything's higher.
Everything was higher, actually, in a lot of cases. Not everything, but a lot of cases, things were higher, right? So as long as you were able to wait that extra year, you were fine. But if you needed to monetize an asset in June of 2020, you're fucked, right? So I think the secret in real estate to me really is, and again, I don't believe in absolutes, so nothing is absolute, but for the most part, you know, it's all about time. If you can create staying power, you will do very, very well. If you cannot create staying power, however you do it, whatever it costs you, you could be stuck in a place where that's not good.
100%. In my experience, most bad deals, unless they're really bad, the location is just terrible, there was a major shift, can usually come back with time. But most people don't have the time that it will take in order to see the recovery, or they don't have the resources to hold it during that period. And I think that's probably what you mean by making your own luck.
Yeah, I think I would add a third point to that. It's most people either don't have the time, they don't have the resources, or number three, this is something I've seen a lot of. I think most people, and even I've seen this with successful and veteran real estate investors, I think most people forget that this is a long game. Like I tell my kids all the time, this is chess. It's not checkers, right? Like it's a long game. And like a year, 2 years in this business, it's like a lifetime. So there are people out there even maybe that could have the resources to stay and just kind of give up and walk away because it's easier to walk away rather than take a little bit more risk or deal with the fire or hold on or do whatever you need to do. And I think that's something that, and it's a hard thing when you're in it. I mean, again, COVID is just a perfect example because it was the entire world and everybody thought the world was ending. Who would have guessed? Who would have guessed in June of 2020 when we were all locked in our homes that 1 year later, most asset values would be like, you know, double, triple, you know, 2 years later. Who would have guessed that? And that's the point, that in this business, it's a lifetime. It's not like the stock market, which I have experience with because I was in that, where today Microsoft's down 10, tomorrow it's up 50, right? And real estate doesn't really move like that for the most part.
The first deal is always a big milestone in anyone's career. When you started your first firm, what was your first deal? How did you identify it? How did you like make that leap?
That's a tough one. That's a little bit of a tough one, but because our first deal was an assemblage, quite frankly, that took so long that by the time we got it done and were able to develop it, we literally did like several other deals, you know, but it's still, I think, the same. This is 2005. My partner and I first got together and he put a deposit down on a 25 footer on 31st between 5th and Madison.
It's for non-New Yorkers, it's 25 feet wide?
25 feet wide. Yeah, I'm sorry. 25 feet wide. Yeah. It's a picture like a very narrow like townhouse, but it wasn't a townhouse. It was New Yorkers, well, it was a taxpayer, but what a taxpayer means, it's retail with like a couple of apartments above it, right? That's what it was. And the plan was to build like a 20-story pencil condo, which was just fucking stupid. I mean, we didn't know what we were doing. This is 20 years ago. I mean, I could say it now. It's fine. And we quickly, it was a hard deposit. And we quickly realized, holy shit, this deal does not work. Just does not work. And we're hard now. So now what do we do? Well, what ended up happening was we quickly realized like assembling a larger site is the only way out of this, because the reason that the site didn't work was because it was only 25 feet wide. You couldn't build a 20-story building. That's what we just didn't know this because we weren't really developers back then, right? We just kind of jumped in. And so we ended up assembling, and that's why it took so long, but we ended up assembling, we bought the building next door. So we made it 40. By the way, I misspoke. It wasn't 20. It was 22 feet wide. Excuse me. It wasn't even 25 feet yet. Because now I remember it was so the lot became 44 feet, which is still really tight, really tight. Then we bought the air rights over the adjacent two buildings, which allowed us to cantilever over those buildings. So our first deal, you don't even know what the fuck we're doing. And now
sounds very complicated.
And now we're building a cantilever. We ended up building this. I still own this building, by the way. It ended up being a very successful deal. It took a long time. So then we assembled this site. We ended up assembling it. By the time we finished assembling it, oh God, this is such a long story. We brought in Richard Mack. Back then it was this is before Aries Area. It was Apollo Real Estate Advisors, like many, many years ago. So Richard, I don't know if he'll get mad at me for telling this story. I don't even know if he remembers this, but he came into the project with us. We got a acquisition and construction loan from Wachovia Securities. This is in 2007, right? When did Lehman collapse? Oh, wait. Yeah. This is like late 2007, right? So now we need like a year, like do our plans, do all the pre-dev, blah, 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 right? September of 2008, which is when Lehman collapsed, we were ready to start drawing our construction loan. Lehman collapses. Wachovia's like, all right, give us like a month. Next month, they're like, give us a month. Next month, they're like, give us a month. Then Wachovia goes under. Right? So now Wachovia goes under. Wells swallows them up. And I guess Richard, that was like a fund. What we were in with him, and it was such a small position because he just invested in the land with us. The fund that we were in was like some $750 million fund, which was invested over like 06, 07. So I guess they had bigger problems to deal with at that because of the financial collapse. So he was kind of like, hey, we're just walking away. We want nothing to do with this. We're walking away. And we were like, well, can we buy your interest for like a dollar? Like, we're going to walk away. I'll buy your interest for a dollar. The joke, whenever I see him at the door, I tell him, I don't think we ever actually gave him the dollar. We still mail a dollar. I don't know what the interest is on that. But we bought his interest out for a dollar. Now Wachovia swallows up. I mean, Wells buys Wachovia, right? This is end of 08 or beginning of 09. And so this is a tiny loan. We had like a $17 million loan, something like that. Tiny compared to what Wachovia had on its book. So we reached out. They wouldn't even call us back. And finally, somebody called us back. We reached out. We're like, hey, what are you guys doing here? They're like, we don't know. We'll get to you when we get to you. So we just figured, you know, we're going to be good guys. We paid the taxes. We paid the insurance. There was no debt service to pay, but we paid. We just kept the thing alive. A year and a half later, they call us. Okay. And they're like, hey, finally got to this asset. We're like, what are you going to do with it? They're like, we're going to just sell the debt. And we're like, what are you going to sell it for? I think it was like 50 or 60 cents on the dollar. We're like, would you let us buy the debt back? They're like, yeah, you guys have been good guys. Sure. Like you've been paying, you know. So we bought our own debt back for like 60 cents on the dollar. Richard's gone for a dollar, which we still owe him, I guess. And so we reset our basis completely on this deal. Long story short, we brought in some new partners and we ended up building a 30-story, 250-room hotel called the Arlo Nomad. That's the deal. That's the story of the Arlo Nomad. That's a deal that we still own today.
Why did you pivot to hotel from condo?
So it's so long ago. I don't know that I remember exactly the reason. I think it was just, I don't remember exactly. I feel like there was a moment in time during this period where hotels, there was like a lack of supply because there was a lot of condo conversions or something like that. And the hotel room rates were very much like, you know, there was like a dearth of supply of that. And the zoning for the site that we had was like, it was a C zone. So we could kind of do whatever we want. We could do, you know, resi, office, hotel, whatever we want. And it was just in vogue and sort of like how we started the conversation. The capital markets, especially after we bought our debt, that was a very, like, people wanted hotels and people wanted that there. There were a lot of people interested in doing a hotel there with us. And we needed a capital partner. We were not in a position at that time yet to figure it out on our own. Right? So
at that time, but you were figuring out the construction. on your own. How did you kind of ramp up the expertise on the construction and development side once you bought the site back for pennies on the dollar?
I mean, we, you know, by the time that happened and we started this project, we actually did do a couple of other deals. So this project had such a long life cycle. By the time we bought our debt back and started construction, I mean, it was almost 10 years when we first started assembling the site. When we started, the Arlo Nomad started construction, I think in 2015. It was 14 or 15, I don't remember now. We finished it in 17. I don't remember if it was 14 or 15, whatever. But so it was almost 10 years from when we first put that 22-foot building, excuse me, under contract. So we did do a couple of other deals. They were smaller, quite frankly. But again, like in anything, you know, we sort of jumped in. And I'm not going to lie to you, we definitely made some mistakes. And we definitely learned some things, especially on the Arlo. You know, that was our first real high-rise together. And, you know, one of the things that we learned that I think we do very, very differently today, because today we're focused exclusively on multifamily ground-up development. That's all we do. We don't do anything else. We don't do hotels. We don't do all that. We used to buy a lot of existing buildings and do, like, you know, very serious, like, renovations. Like, I've done occupied rehabs. I've done all that stuff. We don't do any of that anymore. It's just ground-up, new construction, multifamily, and mostly rental, not really condo. But back then, again, we didn't really have the experience. And we kind of got swept up in the whole, let's find a cheaper contractor that promised us they could do it for 30% less. And then about 8 or 9 months into the foundations, when we were about 7 months behind schedule already, we realized, oh shit, that this is not really going to work. And so, you know, like a lot of things, you know, I'm kind of fortunate in that now I've been doing this as a developer for 20 years, and I've been in the business for almost 25 years. I have the benefit of having made a lot of mistakes and learned from those mistakes. And the truth of the matter is that is the best way to learn. I don't care what anybody else says. Fucking it up is the best way to learn. I mean, there's a reason that, like, the guys who play baseball who are in the Hall of Fame, they struck out 70% of the time, right? Like, and that's why they're in the Hall of Fame, because they took all those swings, right? But we sort of learned, we quickly realized that saving money or trying to save money on the construction, we were in the wrong mindset. And we kind of shifted our mindset a little bit into sort of, hey, we just want to focus on building quality, and we want sort of best in class working for us to build these buildings. And that may not be the cheapest way to do it. But what we ended up finding and what we realized, and we've now proven this out many times over, building will probably get built faster. Building will probably get built with less issues. We'll probably have less issues after the building is complete. So it'll probably get us a higher value anyway. And you don't need as much aspirin for the process.
How has starting a company through the great financial crisis shaped your view of investments and what asset class you wanted to focus on?
You know, I was always attracted to multifamily. I really liked the multifamily business. And especially after having built a hotel. And, you know, when we built the hotel, we were fortunate to partner. We partnered with a company called Quadrum Global. They were a different name before. They're buddies of our, you know, we were partners with them for many years on a lot of deals. We've since bought them out of, I think we bought them out of everything except this hotel's, I think, the last asset we owned together. And one of the reasons that they're such a great partnership there is they actually built out an entire hotel management business. So we're sort of like the limited partner there now, even though we're the minority. They run it because they're the hotel experts. They know. And, you know, we, quite frankly, I don't know how to run a hotel. I wouldn't know the first thing to do with it. But the one thing that I've learned in sort of watching that, which I don't like about the hotel business, honestly, and I knew this from my financing days, but the problem with the hotel business is you're signing nightly leases, right? And so, you know, with a nightly lease, something happens, COVID, God forbid, a terrorist attack, whatever the hell it is, right? Your cash flow can vanish just like that. The problem is your insurance, your real estate taxes, your payroll, that's still the same, right? It's hard to wind that down immediately. You know, with an office building, you know, you sign long-term leases. But the problem there is they're businesses, they're not individuals. So if a business goes under, yeah, you have a long-term lease, but the business went bankrupt. Now what do you do? when you look at apartments, you know, that's somebody's, like rental apartments, that's somebody's home. Something happens, COVID, the end of the world, the Great Depression, whatever the hell it is. That person's going to stop going on vacation. They're going to stop paying for their car. They're going to stop paying for their credit cards. They're going to stop buying Starbucks. The last thing they're likely going to stop paying for is their rent. So that's why I think on the scale, from my perspective, and I think a lot of people in the real estate business view it this way as well, I look at multifamily on one side of the scale as like sort of, you know, security of cash flows. And I want to be careful about saying less risk. There's a lot of risk, but, you know, on the risk spectrum, it's probably on the lower side of the risk spectrum versus the hotel business, which I would say is probably at the other end of that.
You got it.
That's why I like that business, frankly. And I remember in 2008, when the market collapsed, we did have a few small buildings in Harlem that we owned and managed. And in 2008, when the market collapsed, that was a liquidity crisis. There was no money, right? There was a bank here. The banks were all going to fail. There was no money. Well, in 2009, we were still able to refinance those multifamily cash flowing buildings. I was still refinancing buildings in 2009 when nobody could get any money for anything. And that just taught me that, hey, this stuff is gold. That's really what, you know, where we should be focused on. And that's kind of, that's sort of informed our business over the last, whatever, you know, not quite 20 years, but yeah.
What made you want to focus only on development of multi? Because a lot of people develop multi, they own multi, they manage multi, but it seems like you saw a ton of value in only focusing on the development side and refining your process to become best in class or outcompete other people?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I've done it all. I've bought buildings, I've renovated them. I used to do a lot of the rent stabilized business back before they changed the law. Fortunately, we sold all that stuff in 17. Not that we knew anything was coming. That was sort of the natural progression of us going into development. The reason I like development, I think the reason, and I think development scares a lot of people that haven't done it, and rightly so. It is very challenging. It is very hard. But the reason I like it is I think that's the best place to create art. I think that it's really, really hard to create value on existing buildings. It just really is. I mean, sometimes like, there are unique situations, distressed assets, markets turn around. Of course, there are ways to create value there. But I think when you look at the people that consistently create outsized value, I think you have to do something to create that. I think, you know, me outsmarting you on a buy of a building because I think it's worth this and you think it, there's just only so much value I'm going to be able to squeeze out of that. Especially when you're talking about at the institutional level, there's not that many dumb people out there. Right? Maybe when you get down to the small level buying individual apartments, maybe you'll find a sucker here and there, but generally speaking, I think when you're dealing, you know, at an institutional level, I just think the spreads are not really there, the bids versus asks. So I'm not sure how you create outsized value by buying existing assets. Again, you can do it by redeveloping those assets, and we've done that. And the challenge I just think with redeveloping existing assets is there's just so many limitations. And there's so many things, there's so many unknowns. I mean, I've bought existing buildings with tenants that I've completely got renovated. And I've done it many times. We've done it successfully. You never know what's behind the walls. There's always something that you didn't expect, that it always takes longer. And you always end up with layouts or a situation that are not ideal because you're dealing with an existing box. And in many cases, dealing with tenants that may or may not be able to move around to what would be the optimal scenario. Whereas with new development, it's a blank canvas. Do whatever the hell we want. I mean, subject to rules and zoning and et cetera, et cetera. And in development, to me, it allows you to absolutely optimize the real estate. You can squeeze you should be able to squeeze every little bit of juice out of that real estate. There's nothing standing in your way at that point except the execution. And I think what scares people about development is the execution is a lot more challenging. There's no question. But, you know, no risk, no reward. I mean, if you want the outsized reward, you have to be willing to take the outsized risk.
What in your process have you learned to mitigate risks?
Look, I think the top thing, just frankly, is experience. Nothing trumps that. You know, I think I think there's a few things. I think that the way we've structured our business today, a lot of what we're, the development we're doing, we're taking site assemblage and entitlement risk on a lot of the deals that we're doing. So our basis is really low in a lot of deals. Like we're doing deals in Miami, and our true basis on those deals, we're building some of those deals to like 9 caps. And so, you know, when you're able to do things like that, quite frankly, again, remember the story I told you, like the model today is probably not going to be what it's going to be at the end. Well, if you have enough cushion, it probably doesn't matter, right? As long as you can get to the, right? It's like that hurricane strike. It doesn't matter that we circled, you know, Miami 3 times. We got to the Bahamas. I got you there, right? So I think that making sure that you have enough room and enough cushion, you know, where if something goes wrong, you know, you need to be able to stress test the, I think too many people, when they look at these deals, they just assume everything is going to go perfectly. And there's been plenty of deals that I've seen where it's kind of like, well, if I just adjust this just this little bit, your deal completely fucking blows up, right? And I think when you see something like that, that's where you need to kind of run for the hills. I think you need, especially in the development business where there's so many variables and so many things that can go wrong or cost more or take longer, or et cetera, I think being able to have that cushion that you could tap into, whether it be to recap or to refinance or to buy yourself more time or whatever, that I think is probably the best thing that it, that someone can do.
What are the key nuances you've learned about location that have stuck with you?
So, you know, we've done a bunch, and we were, I think, a relatively early investor in Long Island City. We came there, we started developing there 15 years ago. The first deal we did in LIC, we bought the debt on a failed condo called the Crescent Club. It was like half built. You know, we foreclosed on the debt, finished the building. So that was actually the deal that I talked about where everything went right. It was that deal. We assumed it was going to take us years to foreclose. We ended up paying the guy. We got the deed right away. We were like years ahead of schedule. We completely overestimated the budget because we were buying the debt. We didn't have a chance to inspect the building. Didn't cost as much as we thought it was going to cost to finish it. The rents were a lot higher than what we thought they were going to be. You know, one of those. But the location, it's interesting. You know, when I first got to Long Island City, and I'll tell you a great story in a second. When I first got to Long Island City, I mean, there really, where Crescent Club was, there was nothing there. Nothing. I mean, there was a strip club around the corner. That was pretty much it. There was no, if you wanted to move into my building, that building, and you wanted to go buy milk or go grab a slice of pizza, nowhere for you to do that. When we were building that building, there was a gas station catty corner to us with like those service bays for the cars. The owner of the gas station actually opened up a sandwich shop in one of those bays for our construction workers because they had nowhere to fucking eat. So now fast forward, and we built Alta. I don't know if you're familiar with Alta, but we built a 42-story, 472-unit building, which we finished in 2018, also in Long Island City. And back in 2014, when I was shopping for the loan for that deal, we got our construction loan from AIG. A guy named Mike Medvin, who runs the group there. If he's watching this, hey, Mike. So when we were shopping for that construction loan, he came, I don't even know if he, you know, I remember all these stories. A lot of people don't remember these stories, but he came to come see the site. And I don't know if he had a driver or he took an Uber, whatever the hell, however he got there, he took a car over the Queensboro Bridge. It was like 40 minutes late for this meeting, but you know, he's a lender, so I'm waiting. He shows up. He comes to take a look at it. It's a piece of shit, right? There was a strip club there. There was a lot of strip clubs in Long Island City back then. And I look at him, and I saw that he was kind of like, this looks like, the fuck is this? And I said to him, I said, Mike, do me a favor. There was a Subway, like right by our building. I said, Mike, do me a favor. Don't get in your car. Take the Subway back to your office. He took the Subway back to his office. He called me from his office 12 minutes later, inside his office. He's like, get it. They ended up giving us $200 million for that deal. So I think sometimes, you know, we were kind of early to Long Island City. And one of the reasons we liked it a lot was its proximity to New York. And one of the things that we realized early on was that, yeah, it didn't have a lot of the services and a lot of the infrastructure that you would want. But years ago, when we came to Long Island City, people we realized that if we could build the right product, a brand new product, fully amenitized, that's 30 to 40% less than 7 minutes across the bridge on the train, people are going to want that because they're 7 minutes away. They can afford it and they can be in a brand new shiny building. Now, fast forward 15 years later, something like 60,000 units have come in. Now there's multiple Michelin star restaurants, there's drugstores, right? It all kind of filled in. But I think the key was that sort of transit-oriented, you know, location and in close proximity to a very expensive CBD, and a very supply-constrained CBD. So I think, you know, we were fortunate to have sort of the vision, the foresight to say, this is going to get developed and it's going to get better. And again, back then, it didn't even matter. There were no supermarkets. People were picking Long Island City because that was what they could afford. Fast forward today, now people are choosing to live there. It's no longer like, oh, I have to live in Long Island City because that's all I can afford. Now it's, people are like, yeah, I want to live there because it's great. It's great restaurants. It's close to them. Now it's a choice. And I think some of the other sites, some of the other projects that we're doing, like down in Miami, we're doing building a lot in a place called Hialeah. And we kind of saw, when I came down there 5 years ago, I kind of saw the same. To me, it was like a mini, not mini, it's a very, Hialeah is a fifth largest city in Florida or whatever it is, but it, to me, it was exactly what we saw in Long Island City 15 years ago. Transit-oriented, tremendous access to both mass transit, which you don't really get a lot in Florida, but also like some major highways, very close to major employment centers, 15 minutes from downtown, and you have product all around you that is really, really expensive, and an ability for us to deliver product in that area like we did in Long Island City, that's probably going to be 30 to 50% less than what it is 10 or 15 minutes away.
Well, that's another common theme I'm starting to hear from you, and that it's arbitrage. It's arbitrage in maybe what you're buying it for. It's arbitrage on what you could charge versus Manhattan and how that might create demand that wasn't already there.
Mm-hmm.
How else, in terms of like the design and the construction side, are you thinking about creating advantages or little differences? Like, are you guys systematizing, you know, how you do your kitchens or your layout so it's very programmed? Or is every building completely different?
Yeah. Well, I think within the existing buildings, generally speaking, because we're building large scale buildings, they tend to, you know, we have lines of units that all tend to match, you know. Sometimes it does vary building to building. I think one thing to understand about us is, and we've built luxury product before, we've done some condominiums. I think the meat of our business, quite frankly, is we like to build what I call middle class. I want to, you know, I'm sort of wary of the term workforce housing, because I think that connotation comes with like affordable housing where it's like subsidized housing. Not that I'm against that. We've done that too in our history. But to me, what I like to think of it as, we're building for sort of the meat of the market, the middle class of the market. And whatever that may, and that may mean different things in different places. In New York City, middle class has a very different meaning than what it means in Hialeah, right? And so as a rental guy, there's a rule of thumb that you look at for what a person has to make in order to afford to live in your building. Generally, the rule of thumb is 40 times the monthly rent. So meaning like if the monthly rent is $2,000 a month, you got to make $80,000 a year to be able to afford that apartment. That's sort of a general rule of thumb people stick with in terms of, you know, applicants for apartments. So if we use that rule of thumb, well then yeah, in Hialeah, my lowest income tenant's probably going to make about $80,000 a year, while in Long Island City, it's probably double that. I mean, it's a little nutty, right? But that is the sort of quote unquote middle class. That's why I don't love the term workforce housing, because I don't think anybody can equate somebody making $150,000 a year with workforce housing. But, you know, it's, I think for us, that's a product that we're very focused on. It's not to say we don't do luxury. I think in some of the buildings that we're doing, there are going to be some things that we'll do that are luxury. But the meat of what we do is really targeting that sort of, you know, middle class, where we think there's a lot of constraints on supply, where people need, you know, again, we'll stay away from the word affordable, but they need access to quality, you know, relatively high-end housing, right? And so from that perspective, I think the things that we try to focus on, try to look at the amenities, we try to make these buildings, you know, we try to focus on things that people are really going to want and people are really going to use. And also in some cases, things are going to rent apartments. So like, for example, down in Hialeah, you know, we think we're going to have sort of a very, you know, much younger demographic in that entry price point. So we're doing a podcast.
Love it. You just put one in a hotel, actually, and it's booked up. It's awesome.
Yeah. So we're doing like creator spaces, that type of thing. So I think it's more thinking about, you know, who your demographic is, who your customer is. At the end of the day, we're selling. Everybody's selling something, right? We're selling apartments. And so I think we try to put a lot of thought, you know, wherever we are, whatever the market is, who's our customer? What do they want? And what's going to make them want to live in our building? And yeah, sure, price is a big part of it. That's probably the first and the last thing they're thinking about. But there probably are some other small things they're thinking about, because at the end of the day, there's going to be other people like me that are going to offer the same building at a similar price. So what's going to differentiate me? Maybe they're going to want to stay in my building because I've got that creator space. Or maybe we're, you know, we'll have a slightly higher level of service, or do some things that are kind of a little bit, a tiny bit outside the box that tries to differentiate us a little. And that'll vary building to building depending on the situation.
As a multifamily outsider, all I hear is how there's this major housing shortage all over the place. And the stories that you describe where you need to earn $160,000 to live in Long Island City. I mean, you know, we have an investment in a hotel in New York City. I know a lot of people in that hotel don't make $160,000. So they're even moving further out. What in the market or the environment is just stopping you from endlessly building or having 10 development projects going on right now? Because it seems like there's a ton of demand, but there's probably a misalignment with the cost structure, or the land's not available. What are the issues?
Well, let's talk New York first, because that's kind of where I was raised and where the, you know, although today, quite frankly, 70% of our business is in Miami, maybe 75% of, you know,
we're going to get there. I want to talk about Miami, but let's.
Yeah, we're building 3,600 apartments. Less than 1,000 of them are in New York right now. And the reason for that, quite frankly, look, not to get political, but unfortunately I am, but it's a political environment. It has nothing to do, quite frankly, with the cost to build. It has nothing to do with the availability of land. Sure, are there some issues here and there on that stuff, but it's kind of like, you know, if you drop a nuclear bomb on the city and then you complain that, you know, some of the paint fell off the buildings, like, well, that's not really your problem, right? Like, sure. The issue is the tax structure. And, you know, in New York City, here's what I tell people. You could give me land anywhere in New York City for free. Give me the land, I don't care. Fifth Avenue and 55th Street, wherever you want. I cannot afford to build a rental building under the current property tax structure. I just can't with a zero basis. Because you'll be building, and I challenge you, take any deal and go and underwrite it, you'll be building to between a 3.5 and 4.5 cap, depending on how high and how big, right? Why the fuck would you do that? You can go buy existing buildings better than that, right? It's why you're only gonna develop, you know, the rule of thumb, I think today, and it varies depending on where interest rates are, but you don't want to develop if you can't at least get to a 6.5, right? If you can't get there 6.5, maybe for the right deal, 6.25, right? You'll push it. So I'll be pushing 6. But like, you're not going to build if you're at a 4. Why the hell are you doing that? So, and the problem in New York is that the way the property tax system is set up, it doesn't make sense. So, which now dovetails into 421A, right? Which, and I don't know if you're familiar with 421A. So for many years, there's been a tax break in New York City called the 421A property tax exemption. And there's been different versions of it. The last version was Affordable New York. Now it's 485X. But most people colloquially know what is 421A. And what it essentially allows for is, imagine you have a piece of property right now that's vacant and it pays $100,000 a year in taxes, right? Well, if I can't afford to build a building on there, that property's going to stay vacant. It's only going to be paying the $100,000 a year in taxes and there's no housing. What 421A says is, hey, we're going to freeze your taxes for 30 years at $100,000. Build your building, set aside 30% of the units for affordable housing. Well, now what happened? Now you got 30%, you got some, you know, percentage of affordable units that you would have never had. Your city's getting the same taxes that it was always getting, or, you know, would never have gotten more because nobody would have built this building. And in 30 years, the city now is going to be able to up those taxes on the entire building and get a tremendous amount of taxes. But by then, that investment will have gotten to a place where it can service it, so where it makes sense, right? So the way the 421A program works is they always create it, and if they only make it last 5 years. And then every 5 years, there's a fight in Albany with the state over renewing it. And every time they make, it usually lags a couple of years where there's no 421A, people stop building, and then they usually make it worse every time. And this latest iteration called 485X is probably the worst one they've ever created. And what it essentially, the bottom line is, and what I think you're going to see, and I think people are starting to see it, they're forcing you to use prevailing wage to build buildings that are over 100 units. Meaning that if you have a 60 or 80 unit deal, you don't need to use prevailing wage. So what's going to happen is you're going to have a lot of these small buildings getting built, which is great. Doesn't really, you know, when you're 800,000 units short to get out of your housing crisis, I don't see it being solved with a bunch of like 70 unit buildings.
And prevailing wage is basically union labor?
It doesn't necessarily have to be, but it likely does head in that direction. Yes. And so the problem is that increases your cost on average by about 25-30%. And so couple that with the fact that also the affordability now, they've also lowered, meaning you have to have the same amount of affordable units, but they lowered the band, the AMI band. So now you need to create much deeper affordable. So increased costs, much deeper affordability.
Doesn't add up.
The math just doesn't work.
How have you dealt with unions in New York City as a developer?
You know, we tend to build what's called open shop. You know, we exclusively use a company called AECOM, Lehman Builders Group. They're one of the largest construction firms in the world. We build open shop, so our projects are open to union and non-union labor. And quite frankly, the non-union labor that we use, because it's AECOM and they're such a large company, they vet these firms. So in most cases, we're just using the best of the best. And we'll have union subs on our projects. So it's not really, goes back to what I said at the beginning, where if we can't afford to build it the way it needs to be built, then we really couldn't afford, then the project really never worked. And that's sort of a different, you know, mindset. And again, and that when you couple that mindset with what I'm telling you about 485X, the math just doesn't work to build these buildings. And I think we're kind of seeing that. I mean, there's really not a lot of starts. And so I don't see, it's great for someone like me who owns property, someone like me who has, I've got a couple of deals that I grandfathered in on the old program, so I'm still building a couple of buildings. That's great. It means supply is going to stay really tight and rents are only going up. Now, I think there was an article earlier this week in The Real Deal about how New York's going to see another year of record rent. I mean, it's like day one of economics. Like, you want to lower your rents, you got to increase the supply. You want to keep the supply tight? Guess what? Rents are going up, you know? And I don't see that changing for the next 3 to 5 years in New York.
So what brought you to Miami?
You know, I've wanted to get into Miami for many years. I've had a place there for 20 years. And the issue for me is I felt like, you know, I feel like we're experts in the capital markets. We're experts in construction. You know, but once you take us out of our local environment, the reason that I didn't go into Miami for so long was I didn't want to be the schmuck from New York where every local guy in Miami is like, oh, you shouldn't buy that site. And the schmuck from New York comes in and buys that site, right? Because we didn't know. I needed some time to find a local partner there that we could find, that we could partner with, that could help us find some sites that we weren't just making a mistake, quite frankly. We found that partner about 5 years ago, did a couple of deals together. And then we actually bought them out of several of them last summer. And then we're buying them out of the last one, hopefully in the next several weeks. Because now it's been 5 years and, you know, and we're no longer the schmucky New Yorker. Now we're the local guy, you know, we're relatively the local guys now.
How do you identify a partner? It seems like, I mean, we've had a lot of partners. It's hard. How do you find a good one?
Really, really freaking hard. It's really hard. I mean, it's really hard. And I tell people this all the time, you know, it's so easy to get into a partnership. It's so easy to sign those JV docs. What you really don't realize is how hard it is to unwind these partnerships, especially in development deals. And it's so difficult. guarantee considerations, loans, investors. I mean, it's you really have to be careful. I don't know that I have a good answer for this, if you want to know the truth. I feel like in some ways, I've had some not great partners. I've been a little bit lucky in how it's worked out. I've been fortunate. I've had some fantastic partners. And I still do have a lot of fantastic partners. I think at the end of the day, you know, the one thing I've learned is you really can't control how other people are going to behave. I think you need to do the best you can yourself and try to, you know, in this business, at the end of the day, reputation is everything. You know, you're going to have some hits, you're going to have some wins, you're going to have some losses. If you're doing this long enough, like, you know, we gave back a deal years ago, like things will happen. And I think it's how you behave. You know, we gave back a deal in 2017 or 18, I don't remember. And that lender gave me a recommendation for my next loan because of the way we handled ourselves. Because it wasn't our, you know, it's a market-driven issue. And so I think that's the best you can do. I don't know that I have a good answer on how to find the right partner. I mean, it's, you know, in some ways you want somebody, you know, it's almost like, it's pretty much the same as getting married. You don't want somebody exactly like you because if you're both too intense, you fucking kill each other, right? But you don't want somebody, if you're laid back, you don't want somebody laid back either because then you need somebody's got to be aggressive. So ideally, you know, you want to find somebody that maybe is strong where you're weak and maybe weak where you're strong so you can both feel like you're adding a lot of value. And I think the best partnerships are the ones where it's not too one-sided. Meaning like if you can be as close to equal as possible, those I've seen be the best types of partnerships because especially the partnerships where you're not truly equal, taking private equity away. I mean, true partnerships where you're like in the trenches together. You know, it can you want to try to stay away from things that can build resentment over time because the problem is that these deals, they have a long life cycle. Things change. Whatever world you're in today or whatever your thoughts are today, that may not be the case 5 years from now. And you're making a deal today that you're going to have to live with 5 years from now or maybe 10 years from now, right? So it's important to kind of think about it that way and make sure that you don't create situations that will later create resentment.
What surprised you most about getting into South Florida development?
I have a really good story for that one. So we did our first deal. Our local partner wanted to have a groundbreaking. That's not really a thing here in New York, I feel like. Like, I mean, some people do it. When the Quadrum guys first, you know, came to New York, we did it. We did one with them because they had the foreign guys come and, you know, they wanted a picture with the shovels. But most people don't really do that here in New York. So I didn't think it was a big deal. Like my local partner was like, we got to do this big project. It was the biggest project he ever did by, you know, it was a 559 unit deal. The biggest project he ever did before then was 30 units, right? Or something like that. So
wow, we wanted that's to have a big spread.
Yeah,
you must have trusted this guy.
Well, we were doing all the work. So it's
he found the site?
Yeah. So, okay. So he's going to set up the groundbreaking. No big deal. I fly down. I pull up to this groundbreaking. You know, the mayor's there. The deputy mayor. The chief of police. The chief of fire. Telemundo is there. Okay. Like every council person is there. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like, you know, I'm not like used to the mayor's coming up. Thank you so much. The chief of police, here's my card. You have a problem, call me. Like, and I was like, thank you for the jobs and the tax revenue and the this. I said to the mayor, you know, like, I'm not used to this. Like in New York, I want to fucking hide. I want my name on these things. So people are like looking for ways to fuck you. Forget help you. Or forget to just even leave you alone. Like they overtly want to hurt you. And so I think that was the biggest difference was there is, I think, it's not that you could do whatever you want in Miami. There's zoning there and you have to go get approvals and all that kind of stuff too. But I think there is a different mindset around supply and demand there, where I think generally speaking, politically, they're largely pro-development. And even the ones that are, you know, I don't want to say anti-development, but are more careful about development, they don't look at us as the enemy. I think in New York, developers are just looked at as the enemy. We are the reason rents are so high. Forget the fact that there's just not enough apartments for people, right? And we're the only ones that can build them. But we're the reason rents are so high. I think that in Miami, that's not a thing. That's not a thing. I think people there, or at least the political class there, respects the fact that we're part of the solution. If there's an affordability crisis, we're part of the solution. We're not the problem. And that we still need to work together. We still, we still need to make sure that development is measured and careful and, you know, don't do crazy things, but it is a very different mentality from what I've seen.
How did you set up your team and your process having split your time between New York and Florida? Because when you're doing it in New York, you could just walk to the site and check things out or go to the OAC meeting. How did that change in Florida and what did you do?
Well, we built a team down there, first off. So we have a head of construction that's based down there. We have an office down there. My head of construction here, he's there right now, actually, as we speak. And I just came from there yesterday. Between the two of us, we're probably in Miami, you know, 2 weeks out of every month. So I think, again, at first, we were leveraging our local partner, quite frankly. So that was an additional help. They were our sort of on the ground eyes and ears, right? And then as we built our team, we were able to sort of rely on that less and less. But the nice thing about Miami is not a difficult place to get to from New York. I mean, I can literally, it's 2:00 right now. I can close this thing out right now. And if I run, I could be in Miami in time for dinner right now. It's an easy place to get to. But that being said, there are some unique challenges of being based here, but it's important. It was important for us to have competent eyes and ears on the ground that are there day to day. I think you need that. I don't think we would be doing everything we were doing down there if we hadn't opened up an office and really made the commitment to like staff, like senior people there, not just, I'm not talking about like a couple of secretaries. I mean, like a real head of development and assistant, you know, people that can actually handle this.
Do you set up that office where the expectation is that team there should be sourcing deals, doing their own development, or is that your role? How does that work in the company?
No. The people we have down there are really meant for execution, you know, on the ground execution of what we have. The sourcing and that stuff. And truthfully, again, we're not really, you know, look, we're not doing more than a couple of deals a year. So it's not like we're doing like 10 deals a month. We're, you know, sourcing deals left and right. I mean, most of what we're doing at this point, it's assemblage and entitlement work. So we have guys on the ground that'll help us with the assemblages. We're not really market buyers like we're buying the stuff from Spies and those guys. We're not those guys these days. That's not to say that we won't ever do that. We did do that in the past, but that's not our business today.
What are you most worried about in your business right now?
That's a great question. What am I most worried about in my business right now? You know, I'm torn between giving you what I think the market is more worried about versus what I'm more worried about.
I want to know what you're worried about.
I worry, well, and it's different. So in New York, I worry about crime. And I know that doesn't sound like a real estate problem, but it is a real estate problem. Because at the end of the day, if people don't feel safe in this city, they're not going to want to live in this city. If they don't want to live in this city, that's going to be not good for my real estate. Right, or for anybody's real estate. So I worry, and it does feel like the winds are shifting a little bit. I've been saying this for probably almost 10 years. If you want to know my biggest concern with multifamily real estate in New York City, it's crime. It's not interest rates. It's not quality of construction. It's not, you know, it is just crime. Because if people don't feel safe, they're not going to want to buy apartments. They're not going to want to spend. I mean, New York City's not fucking cheap. It's fucking expensive. You got to spend a lot of money to live here. So there's got to be a social contract in exchange for that. What are you getting in exchange for that? So you're spending more money to live in a smaller space with less stuff to get stabbed when you walk out. It doesn't sound like a good trade, right? You need, so I think that still worries me. And I hope and pray that we get some sanity in office at the state level that starts to overturn some of these ridiculous bail programs that we have that just keep letting these career criminals, you know, rob someone and be out the next 2 hours.
Or
push someone off, you know, off a subway track. Or, I mean, it's ridiculous. And there was a picture in the Post the other day from a subway platform and everybody's standing up against the wall. Right. Come on. Like that just shouldn't be. There is a lack of leadership and accountability. I think when you have people feeling that way, so that's what scares me in New York. You know, in Miami, that's not really an issue, quite frankly. I think the political leadership does very, very well with that. So I'm not too concerned with crime. I think in Miami, really, you know, the only concern I have is I do worry a little bit about insurance. I think, you know, we've gone into our deals very eyes open with what insurance, you know, really is down there. I think a lot of people, especially that come from New York, get really shocked by that, what the insurance, like on a per unit basis, what the insurance costs really be. Again, we're taking assemblage risk. We have low basis, so we're building to a high yield. So we can afford to be a little wrong. Like, it's okay, right? I'm not building to a 5.75 yield where, fuck, my insurance is left an extra $100. I'm screwed.
You're done.
Right? So that, you know, and it worries me because, look, you see what's happening in Los Angeles. We see all these are terrible, terrible things. But whenever any big natural disaster like this happens, it has an effect on insurance. So that is definitely something that I'm thinking about in the back of my mind, you know, what happens with that over time.
What's the biggest opportunity in Miami?
You know, I still believe we're big, big believers in Hialeah. I mean, we have three projects there right now. We're going to be building, just with the sites that we have under control right now, we're building 12, almost 1,900 units just in Hialeah. And I see that, quite frankly, as the next, like, relatively speaking, Long Island city. I see that today as a place that when I build these units, you're forced to live there because you're chasing a rent. But I look 10 years from now, and I think people, and that's not to knock, Hialeah is a great place, and a lot of people do want to choose to live there because their family is from there, their friends are there, they've grown up there. But I think what you're seeing being pulled into these buildings is similar to what we saw in New York. I think you're going to see people that just cannot afford to be in Wynwood and Brickell anymore, but they still want to be in a brand new building. That doesn't exist right now in Hialeah, not really. And so when we're done with these buildings, you're going to be able to live in a Class A building, fully amenitized, which does not exist in Hialeah, for a fraction of the cost of what it costs you in Wynwood and Brickell. And I think that's going to create a self-fulfilling sort of prophecy that is going to bring a lot of change to that neighborhood over the next 10 years. And 10 years from now, not only will the local people in Hialeah want to choose to live in Hialeah, but other people will say, hey, I really want to live there. You know, and I think that's the change that I see coming sort of 10 years from now.
The other thing about Hialeah is geographically, it's not far from where a lot of people work or where a lot of people want to be, because there's no public transportation in South Florida like you have in New York City. So they're building a lot of homes and multifamily out west.
Well, they do have it now in Hialeah. You have the Metro Rail and the Tri-Rail, which is literally in front of the sites that we're building. So you literally, if you work
right downtown, that's true.
If you work at the Miami airport, you're two stops away from work. Which is the Miami airport, I think, is the, I don't know if it's the first or the second largest employer in all of Miami, right? So you have the employment center there, Hialeah Hospital, two blocks away from us. And yeah, if you work in Brickell or you want to hang out there, or you want to get to Wynwood, you know, boom, you're right there. So those things, I think, you know, are really, really, you know, those are the types of things that I think we look for from a transit oriented perspective that I think are going to really attract people to the area and help continue to sort of fill that area in.
In 5 years, what would you like to be doing more of and what would you like to be doing less of?
In 5 years, you know, honestly, in 5 years, I kind of see myself doing the same. I don't really see much change. I'm 49, right? I'm going to be 50 this year. I don't know that I see much changing for me in 5 years. You know, I think we'll still be doing the same thing. Let me change that answer a little bit. In 5 years, I think we will be finished with all of the development we have here in New York. So I'd love to be able to be doing more development here in New York. Hopefully I'll be able to do that. Hopefully some things will change and we'll be able to kind of jump back into New York the way we have been for the last 20 years. So I'll change the answer a little bit from that perspective.
The last place I want to go is your hold strategy, because a lot of developers don't have a hold strategy. A lot of their money comes from private equity. It's very transactional. They're probably selling it on CO or upon stabilization. You've pivoted from the early part of your career to now to wholly owning things and holding things. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, and we don't really wholly, I mean, we're the majority of the equity in a lot of the deals that we're doing. or actually there's one deal where we're 50% of the equity, but it's with a family that wants to hold long term. I mean, that was our business in the beginning because just frankly, we didn't have much money. We were partnering with private equity. We were 3% of the equity, 5%, maybe 10%, right? And so even if you hit your promotes, you're not owning more than 20, 22% of these deals. We were able to recap a couple of deals, but for the most part, it's really hard to buy your partners out when you're 20% of the equity, best case, right? And the private equity guys, they have to turn because they want to raise fund two, fund six, whatever. They want to get that IRR and move on. So yeah, we were in that same business, that transactional sort of sell on CEO, sell on stabilization, whatever. And, you know, as we've grown and we've, you know, been able to make some more investments ourselves, the strategy really, we have shifted, I think, to that phase of our business where we're trying to build assets that we can hold on to long term. And the best way to describe it is, you know, that private equity business, it's a great way to, as a developer, to get rich. This is the way that you build, I think, wealth. That's the difference. And that's what we're trying to do now, I think, in this phase of our business is build these assets, hold on to them long term. You know, look, we're economic animals. Maybe we sell one or two. We'll see what happens. But for the most part, you know, we because of our ownership stakes, we can control our destiny.
I ask all the guests on the podcast the same closing question, and that is, what is your favorite hotel? You can't pick the Arlo Nomad.
I wasn't going to, but like to stay at? You meant to stay at?
Yeah, to stay at that you've been to.
No, then I'm definitely not picking the Arlo Nomad.
You don't like the small rooms?
I don't like the small. No, it's a great hotel. If any of my partners were Jared, Anoop, I'm really sorry. I didn't mean that. Love the hotel.
It is a great hotel. I agree.
No, my favorite hotel. Wow, that's a really tough one, man. That's a tough one.
You can pick a couple.
Look, I love the Eden Rock in St. Bart's. I just came from there a couple of weeks ago.
I'll be going there soon, actually. Yeah. It doesn't get any better.
That's one of my favorite places. I mean, it's going to sound so cliche when I say all these hotels, but actually, you know what I really love? You know, I love the Nell in Aspen. I love the little Nell. That's a great one. And then I also think, although the service, you know, we haven't been in a number of years and the service wasn't great last time we were there, but just in terms of how much they spent and how beautiful it is, you know, I do love the Caribbean. The Four Seasons Anguilla, I think, is one of the, you know, I'm not sure that you could afford, it was built like during the height of like the craziness. And I don't know that you could afford the amount of marble that is in that. I don't know that you could afford to build something like that in the Caribbean ever again.
It'll never get built again. It was one and only. And, you know, Barry Sternlicht bought it for pennies on the dollar and then made it a Four Seasons.
Yeah, I remember that. So just for that reason alone, I think that's a really special property. And I don't know that not sure that you could replicate that. And then I'll throw one last one out there. The Aman in Kyoto.
Oh, why do you like that?
I was there. I went to Japan for the first time last March, April with my wife. Just so relaxing, so very zen, very kind of like peaceful, really, really incredible place. Really incredible.
Awesome recommendation. I love that. Thanks for coming on the podcast. This is a lot of fun.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Hey everyone, it's Jake here. Thanks again for joining me on this conversation. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Lastly, don't forget to follow me on Twitter @ Jay Wurzak. I'll see you in the next episode.
Jake Wurzak is the founder and CEO of Dove Hill Capital Management. All opinions expressed by Jake and his guests are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Dove Hill Capital Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not reflect or represent real estate, financial, or investment advice.